Hey guys, how's it going? Oh, good. Well, good. Oh yeah, here I am thinking my email works when it doesn't. Trying to send an email when I know better. Yeah, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I just got a friend's bad news. Nothing to, you know, personal to me, but right before going on the air, I found out something horrible happened to some innocent person for no good reason whatsoever. And I forgot to turn my ringer off. So my phone sounds like the oven. Anyway. All right, so it's the show, the Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, I'm going to talk about some things. I guess I don't have any interviews. Nobody could do an interview. I got Jim Bovard lined up for Friday. If that makes you feel any better. I should put out a tweet that there's a show today. I can't post on my site because my site is still down. There is a show. Go to LRN.fm, everyone. All right. Yeah. All right. So we got the Iran deal. We got, I think, Oklahoma City bombing. We got Yemen. Oh, that would be a surprise. I like that one. Nick Turse on the invasion of Africa. And I know that you're saying, but that's scores of countries. Giant continent. What do you mean invasion? The whole place. Oh, yeah. Nick Turse is on it. No one else in the world is on this beat the way he is anyway. The invasion of Africa. The pivot to Africa. And then also police state news. Plenty of police state news. Yeah, my server, it exploded. And apparently the hard drives were saved, but apparently it's difficult to get them working in another computer or some kind of thing. I don't know. They don't work. So if you've sent me an email anytime since last Friday night, I haven't gotten it. if you really need to reach me, try scott@antiwar.com. I can still get those. But, yeah. Anyway, also, my archives are down, so nobody can hear anything. I wonder what percentage of my regular listening audience I'm going to lose for having no server for a week. Probably a lot of them. Probably a lot. Oh, well, whatever, dude. It's all right. I guess I should have listened to Sneaker when he said, I think you should do a Kickstarter for the server first, dude. I said, no, man, I already got this guy online. We got to do the YouTube project first and whatever. I didn't realize how long it takes to get a Kickstarter thing going. And things kept coming up, too. Anyway, so I guess Sneaker was right. He's the server guy. He said it's going to bloat up, and then it bloat up. So, anyway. But, of course, I'm still live at LRN.fm, so you can hear me live, like right now, if you're hearing me right now. And also, you can hear this, you know, days from now, whenever it finally gets fixed, too. In MP3 format, because I'm recording, too, so it'll be all right. Everyone who really wants to hear it will get a chance to hear it. All right. So, yeah, man, I was going to try to get Larry Wilkerson, Lawrence Wilkerson, on the show. Colin Powell's former aide, who's now doing penance for helping lie us into war with Iraq. And I was going to ask him to describe what it would take, because I know he's been over this, what it would take, what a war with Iran would look like. As Senator Tom Cotton says, oh, come on, it'd be a cakewalk. We'd just bomb them for a few days, like Clinton in Operation Desert Fox. Which, am I still the only one who thinks it's kind of strange that Bill Clinton named that operation after one of Hitler's generals? I mean, he wasn't from the Nazi party, but he sure served Hitler in the war when he could have just as easy killed the Nazis and stopped them from being the government of Germany, and he sure didn't do that, so. It's funny, I hear people apologize for him. I make that point. Wow, Bill Clinton named a war after Rommel, the Nazi, and they go, oh, he wasn't a Nazi. Oh, no, he just killed whoever Nazis told him to kill, so that makes him less guilty somehow, I guess. Bill Clinton named a war after a Nazi. Desert Fox. Give me a break. Operation Delay the Impeachment debate on the House floor in the U.S. Congress. Over felonies that his Justice Department would have put you in prison for. Perjure yourself in front of a grand jury, a federal grand jury, on any issue. And then count how long it takes till you get to see daylight again. Anyway. I don't know. I'm feeling bad for my friend who just emailed me about the horrible thing that happened to somebody that he cares about. It's a hell of a thing. Anyway, sorry. Distracted. I'm doing a live radio show and I'm kind of distracted. Yeah, later on the show I will talk about the Oklahoma City bombing. I hope to have an interview. Try to get Roger Charles on the show maybe. And see if we can talk about that sometime this week. It's the 20th anniversary of the Oklahoma bombing, 22nd of Waco. Like I said, Jim Bovard's going to be on the show on Friday to talk about that. And anyway. Yeah, sorry, I spaced out and forgot what point I was failing to get to over there. I do that too much. You know, I was watching Ron Paul, who's like 78 or something like that. And he gave this long, rambling speech on all different topics and back again, but he never forgets what he's talking about. He'll go on a long-ass tangent, but he always gets back to what he was going to say. Not me. I go on long-ass tangents, and then I get lost. For all I know, I was talking about Nick Turse in Africa. Yeah, Nick Turse keeps writing about the invasion of Africa. I'm going to try to get him on. Tom Dispatch, Tom Editor, Englehart, said he's going to work with me to help me get Nick Turse on the show next week. He's got another one about the invasion of Africa coming out next Tuesday. So maybe I'll get to interview Nick then. But yeah, man, that's a hell of a story. And he's got one. It's running on antiwar.com today, and it's also at tomdispatch.com. The Battlefield of Tomorrow. 2044 or bust. Military missions reach record levels after U.S. inks deal to remain in Africa for decades. Try to always keep up on my Nick Turse. He's also the guy that wrote that book, Kill Anything That Moves, about the war in Vietnam. And by anything, they mean the South Vietnamese civilians they were supposedly there to protect. All based on army documents from their own war crimes investigations. Good, good stuff. Anyway, so yeah, that's running at antiwar.com right now. The U.S. military's Battlefield of Tomorrow. And it's Africa. Anyway, thanks for sticking around. I'll be back in a minute. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe.
Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
There we go. I don't know. They say never trust a man with an AOL email address. I guess in this case. Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Yeah, see if maybe I can get Roger Charles on the show. All right, so yeah, I want to talk about the Oklahoma City bombing a little bit, but then again, if I can get Roger Charles on the show today, then I don't really want to spoil it or anything. Well, anyway, I'll start with Iran. Basically, they got an Iran deal in the Senate. Obama gave in and the Senate gave in, kind of both, a little bit, and they got a compromise kind of a thing. Obama will not veto. Apparently, they had the numbers to override his veto. Senate compromises on Iran deal. Obama will sign the bill. That's at news.antiwar.com. And this is where I had spaced out in the last segment, talking about, right, about Wilkerson and possible war. Senate compromises on Iran deal. Obama will sign bill. Bill will give Congress the ability to veto the diplomatic deal with Iran. Top Senate Foreign Relations Committee members have reported a compromise, and the White House has backed off a threatened veto. The details of the compromise aren't totally clear, but will include reducing the 60-day review period of the Iran deal to 30 days, though the period would be extended under certain circumstances, including if the deal is submitted during the summer recess, as it may well be. The White House had long threatened a presidential veto on the bill, and their backing down seems to reflect the reality that it's going to have enough support to override such a veto. White House officials did express reservations about linking the nuclear deal with terrorism, however. The broad purpose of the bill is to give Congress the ability to veto an international deal with Iran. Israel's been pushing hard for them to have such a power, since they would almost certainly block anything Israel objects to, which is basically any deal at all. Apparently resigned to the likelihood of a veto override at any rate, Senate Democrats have been working with the White House to try to weaken the language of the bill in the hopes of making it somewhat more palatable. Whatever the final language, it is a serious blow to the negotiations. Will make it harder for the negotiators to credibly pledge to keep up their end of any deal. Yeah, well, good going, Rand Paul. He could have at least died trying, you know, but nah. Right on board that bandwagon. And anyway, I still kind of am a little bit optimistic. I think maybe Jason is being a little too negative here, but then again, he understands it better than I do, probably. I don't know. But it seems to me like review period after the final deal. Not they're putting on new sanctions right now to prevent a new deal from, you know, the final deal from being signed with the details and everything. But then they'll have 30 days, maybe 60 to pass new sanctions after the final deal and after the Iranian side is expected to start complying by the deal, and the Americans are expected to start lifting the sanctions. And after they have a final deal with the entire United Nations Security Council plus Germany, or the permanent members plus Germany. Which I don't know if they're on the Security Council right now or not. It's a rotating thing if you're not a permanent member, but regardless, they're the other major power in Europe, of course. And so, I think the politics are still with the president at this point. Even though this is a big setback, I guess, in a way, and it could, as Jason says, it could undermine the rest of the talks. where John Kerry's got to get out there and tell these guys, nah, don't worry, it'll be all right. And the Congress is clearly in the pocket of a foreign power and are willing to even override a presidential veto, if necessary, to destroy this deal one way or the other. At least that's how it looks. It is, again, a compromise between the two sides, but and it's amazing. And all based on a bunch of hokum, right? Like in that Politico story from yesterday where, oh, yeah, no, the Republicans aren't basing their opposition on science. No, indeed not. Yeah, don't bore me to death with details of how light water reactors don't produce plutonium that the Iranians could possibly use to make bombs with. Yawn. You know what? How about Iran, danger. Israel, fear, scary. That's the kind of persuasion that a conservative will take right to. Fear? Islam? Oh, no. Did you hear what he said? Nuclear, fear, Islam, bad deal. That Barack Obama's going to sell us out to the mullahs now. Yeah, who needs science when you got a sort of kind of compilation of slogans there to pass for an argument? So, I don't know. There you go. In reality, the deal is far beyond what should be expected of the Iranians. They only ever had a civilian electricity program anyway, a safeguarded one. Oh, possibly they had done some research experiments, but about 99% of those accusations are nothing but hot air. And then on whatever was true about it, even Mossad and the CIA agree with each other that it all stopped in 2003, and they've made no political decision to seek a nuclear weapon. And here they are, really bending over backwards. Now, we could have had this deal back in 2003 with the so-called golden offer before their nuclear program was anything but research experiments, civilian and or otherwise at all. And the Bush administration just wouldn't work with them whatsoever. In fact, even told the Swiss ambassador or the Swiss representative who brought the golden offer forward to go to hell, and how dare you even bring this offer before us. We don't talk to evil, the evil men said. And that deal said, yeah, we're willing to negotiate our role in backing Hamas and Hezbollah, and we're willing to talk oil and infrastructure deals with you guys, and we're willing to talk about the nuclear program. And hey, if you need our help invading Iraq, you'll be fighting a war for us for the next 5 or 6 years at least. We could coordinate on that, if you'd like. And the Americans told them to go to hell all the way around. And then set about fighting a 5 or 8 year war for them. Anyway. Getting rid of Saddam for them. Anyway, so could have had this deal back in 2003. But the point is now they've agreed to major restrictions on their enrichment, changing their heavy water reactor to a light water one, and expanding inspections for a program that never was a threat in the first place, and just for some sanctions relief, not welfare, but just stop stealing. It's a fair deal. More than fair. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, y'all, run out and get a copy of Embedded Alive, First Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14 by Chris Braswell. The book takes a gonzo look at daily life in America, columns, informational letters, and other marketplace vigilance, a look at drug abuse culture and its marketing, and a series of contemplative and metaphysical essays. Get Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14, in paperback, hardcover, and digital formats at fusepowder.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So this is interesting. Robert Perry's got one at consortiumnews.com. Did money seal Israeli-Saudi alliance? And I haven't read it yet, but I just started scanning through it, and one of the first things that I noticed was him bringing up this reference to Alexander Haig's talking points memo, so to speak, that he brought back from his trip to the Middle East in April 1981, right after Reagan took office. He sent Secretary of State at that point, Haig, "I am in the chair. I am in command." Sent him to the Middle East. And Haig came back and said that Jimmy Carter had given the green light to Saddam Hussein through King Fahd. Oh, Saudi Prince Fahd at that time. He wasn't the king yet. "It was interesting to confirm that President Carter gave the Iraqis a green light to launch the war against Iran through Fahd," Haig wrote in the document Perry discovered in U.S. congressional files in 1994. Though Carter has denied encouraging the Iraqi invasion, which came as Iran was holding 52 U.S. diplomats hostage, Haig's talking points suggest that the Saudis, at least, led Hussein to believe that the war had U.S. blessings. Yeah, I think it goes a little further than that. Anyway, yeah, he's being conservative in his accusations. Anyway, boy, this is one of these long ones. But the breaking story is that he's saying the Saudis gave some giant, he calls it a dowry in his introduction here, $16 billion. The Saudis gave Israel $16 billion to cement an alliance. And I don't know how many sources he's got or what, but I give the guy credit. He's been really good, and yeah, mostly on Republican scandals and neocon scandals, and not so much things that Democrats do. Eh, is all right. But he's been really good on, you know, the October surprise of 79 or 80, 81, and ever since then on Iran-Contra and all the messing around down in Nicaragua and... I think he did. I don't know. Others. Anyway, he covered the American side of the scandal, at least. And then he's been very good on the neocons and, you know, Dick Cheney and the neocons and Israel and lots of stuff. Really good on Ukraine the last year and a few months, too. Year and a half, I guess. So I take him as pretty credible. Sometimes he runs stories that are just based on one source, but... he says that, you know, it's not like he pretends he has two sources when he doesn't or anything. And then, usually it's pretty good stuff. I'm not sure. But, and not like two sources magically mean that it's definitely true now or whatever. It's just, that's the standard is all. But anyway, so there you go. Robert Perry, did money seal the deal? I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I figured I'd let you know. Did money seal the Israeli-Saudi alliance? That looks like a good one. All right, so, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to hear back from Roger Charles or not. I'd like to, but I would like to tell you a little bit about the Oklahoma City bombing anyway, since there's this article in The Guardian, Oklahoma City bombing, 20 years later, key questions remain unanswered. Wouldn't that be great if this was running on the front page of every paper? Do people still really read papers at all? This is the story that they never ran in the Austin American-Statesman, not one time ever. For years and years and years and years and years and years. Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols faced three trials and a vast FBI investigation, but many details of their attack remain unexplained. That's putting it very charitably. They remain explained and in ways that incriminate the national police forces, and that's why you're not told the truth. This is by Andrew Gumbel in The Guardian. And Andrew Gumbel is the co-author with Roger Charles of the book Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Matters. Right? They gotta put in the subtitle, Why It Matters That People Got Away with the Mass Killing of 190 people, 187 or 88 people or something. Really. Yeah, why it matters. Because they have to overcome this steep hill to climb that it even matters that the government let people get away with that attack. And here he quotes the lead federal prosecutor. Where's the damn quote? I'm paging down. I'm finding the quote. If you convicted McVeigh but did not get the death penalty, that would not be okay, said Scott Mendeloff, one of the McVeigh prosecutors. We could not lose this. That's not the quote I was looking for. But that's his explanation. They absolutely had to get a death penalty conviction of McVeigh, and if they brought more defendants into the thing, then that would mean that maybe he would live. I think maybe, because someday he might talk and change his mind about what a great martyr he wants to be. But wait, there's a better quote here. Yeah, here we go. See? Larry Mackey, the number two prosecutor against McVeigh and the lead prosecutor against Nichols, has acknowledged his team did not entirely believe it either. It's spinning like hell, but still admitting the truth here. Quote, the number two prosecutor in the McVeigh federal trial and the lead prosecutor in the Nichols federal trial says, quote, if you had said to us, anybody in the room 100% confident that McVeigh was alone, raise your hand, and we would have all kept our hands in our laps. These bureaucrats, take responsibility for your own actions. Speak English. Well, let me put it this way. If we were all together in a room and were made to raise our hands of what we believed, in other words, yeah, we all knew that they had help, that we let them get away. And then that was their excuse. I read the excuse first. Yeah, but we had to get a death penalty conviction of McVeigh, so we couldn't muddy that water. As though they were going to have trouble getting a federal jury, or a state one if they needed backup, to sentence McVeigh to death for his role in that thing, when it could easily be proved, quite easily be proved, that he drove the truck that day, regardless of whatever else he did, whether he made the bomb or not, or et cetera, et cetera. He drove the truck, and any jury in this country would have put him to the needle. Give me a break. Like, that was at risk. If only they had told the truth, that Andre Strassmeyer put him up to it, and that he was working for who? CIA, DEA, FBI? That the ATF had an informant inside, as they write in this article here, the ATF had an informant named Carol Howe inside the white supremacist compound at Elohim City in eastern Oklahoma. And she was reporting on basically a bunch of FBI informants and flip states witnesses double-crossing each other and talking about this attack. And she was warning them. And, you know, in fact, it was Bob Ricks, who was the spokesman for the FBI during Waco, who then became the head of the Tulsa office, who told the ATF when he found out about their investigation, you guys back off. We're not going to have you screw this up like you did the Waco thing. We're in charge of this thing. And then how in charge of it were they when the attack happened anyway? And then the thing is, the names of the others unknown are known. And they're published in this book by Andrew Gumbel and Roger Charles. Read them at The Guardian today.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, anyway, so yeah, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott, and it's my show. By the way, Roger Charles, the co-author of this book with Gumbel, who's writing in The Guardian today. Again, the article is called... It's kind of long. Oklahoma City Bombing 20 Years Later, Key Questions Remain Unanswered. It's by Andrew Gumbel, and he's the co-author with Roger Charles of a book called Oklahoma City. Anyway, called Oklahoma City. I forgot the subtitle just now. But anyway, so here's the deal about that. So Gumbel is a Guardian writer, an English liberal type. Labor Party type, I guess you'd call him over there, right? Who fits right in at the New America Foundation and did an hour-long presentation with Peter Bergen, who is the Al-Qaeda expert there and oftentimes Warhawk. But anyway, so he's their kind of terrorism expert leader guy at New America. And he did an hour-long thing with Gumbel about this. And Roger Charles, he's a former producer for 2020, ABC 2020. I think that's how he got onto this case in the first place and ended up making friends with J.D. Cash, who was the original investigative reporter on this for the McCurtain Daily Gazette there in Oklahoma. And so the thing of it is, I think, when you do hear about Oklahoma City, you know, alternative explanations or whatever, you're made to think, oh, that's a right-wing conspiracy theory. That's like some WorldNet Daily type crap. And it's true that there is a whole WorldNet Daily version of this that has the Arabs doing it, that has Al-Qaeda doing it, and Al-Qaeda as a front for Saddam Hussein, because they had an agenda like that back then. There's really no reason to believe that Nichols learned about his bomb-making from Ramzi Youssef. There is kind of a incidental time overlap at some point, but it seems pretty clear that Nichols went to the Philippines so that he would be out of town when the damn thing happened. Then he ended up coming home anyway, but he was basically there for his alibi, was all. That's my best impression anyway. No reason to believe that he was down in Cebu City meeting with Ramzi Youssef. And Ramzi Youssef was not an Iraqi intelligence agent. Give me a break. That's a bunch of Lori Milroy crap. Nobody believes that, except over at the American Enterprise Institute. But anyway, so it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory, because Andrew Gumbel's no right-winger. He's a British Labor Party liberal type. And Roger Charles, he may be personally like a conservative Republican type, although I don't mean to assume that and accuse him of that. But I just mean, you know, personally he may be kind of conservative, but he's no right-wing wing nut or anything like that. He comes to this from journalism. Is how he got onto this story. And then you can also read James Ridgway and Mother Jones did a great piece all about this based on the story of Jesse Trenadue. Again, no kind of right-winger or conspiracy theorist. Jesse Trenadue's a victim in the Oklahoma bombing. He wasn't there that day and personally affected by the bombs, themselves. But he's the brother of a guy who was murdered by federal cops at a federal transfer facility prison, tortured, beaten to death in his cell in what is, I guess, you know, 99% proven fact that, or at least very solid, educated assumption that they thought he was someone else. They thought that he was Richard Guthrie, who is very likely one of the John Does, with McVeigh, and very possibly the guy riding shotgun in the Ryder truck the day of the attack. And but so the problem for them is that Kenneth Trenadue, who they murdered, had as a brother Jesse Trenadue, a very brave man and a lawyer at that. And so he knew how to file all the right paperwork in all the right places to make sure that they were not allowed to cremate his brother, that he got his brother's body as evidence of what they had done to him. And then he had standing to sue. And his lawsuits just led to the Oklahoma bombing. It's not like he was trying to make it that way. It's that that's why his brother was dead. A case of mistaken identity for one of McVeigh's John Doe co-conspirators. And so his lawsuits led to all this information coming out, including, you know, documents proving that, you know, the government agents admitting to each other that how many witnesses they have who saw McVeigh with somebody else, how many video cameras were recording at the time and from what angles, and all these kinds of things. Secret Service talking to DOD and CIA and FBI documents about the PATCON operation of infiltrating the radical right, supposedly to neutralize them, not help them blow up a giant freaking building full of little children. And anyway, that's the reason for the cover-up, is because McVeigh's buddies had were all in trouble with the law anyway. They were a bunch of neo-Nazi bank robbers and white supremacist loons from this, again, Elohim City, this compound in eastern Oklahoma, with their weird cult-like white supremacist religion. And they all were in trouble with the law one way or the other, and what they were doing out of prison was they'd all made agreements to testify or to be informants or, you know, to cooperate with the feds. And that's the same reason for the clampdown. And that's the most generous explanation, because you could go much further with the story of Andre Carl Strassmeyer, who is apparently, by all evidences, not really a Nazi at all. He was just working for the German and the American government, infiltrating this group. And he was German, and he, you know, knew the history well enough that he could recite all the slogans. And I don't think it's still actually a proven fact which agency he was working for, but he was quite apparently on loan to the U.S. government from the German government for just this kind of operation. And but rather than just being an informant and helping find out the truth in order to stop bad guys, apparently he served a very important role as an agent provocateur and making sure that the attack happened. And so, you know, whether that was the plan all along or not, again, I think also is unproven. But there's a lot of smoke and apparently quite a bit of fire there. And so certainly that's all you need for the cover-up. And now go back to, at least in my mind, what was the most important, you know, series of questions coming out of the Oklahoma bombing thing were about how come Congress is not holding a single hearing on this thing, man? How come there are all these obvious, humongous holes in this story, and yet rather Jennings and Brokaw and apparently every editor of every daily newspaper in America is just going to go along with this? And you can read an AP story about Carol Howe, the ATF informant inside the FBI's terrorist plot, in the Associated Press, for example. Reuters, they're based out of England. They would carry some stories here and there, but they never got any traction. McVeigh may have had help, may have had a lot of help from a bunch of Nazis. Yeah, let's hear that story, everybody. But instead, it was, as the author of one book put it, let them eat OJ. Here's your silly little celebrity trial where everybody knows the truth and everybody knows that the outcome of the trial will not recognize the truth. And who cares? That's because TV tells you to care about something. That's good enough for you, really? What's the most important violent crime of 1995? It wasn't in Westwood. Not to diminish what happened to the two innocent victims of the butcher with the knife there, but damn, dude. they got away with it. And all the major media and all of our supposed democratic institutions let them get away with it, too. And, you know, look at the McVeigh trial, even. The trial was nothing but a parade of crying children. Really? Okay, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, here is a 14-year-old girl who is devastated because she lost her entire family and some body parts in this horrific atrocity. Go ahead, young one. Tell them about your feelings. Are you sad? You are? Oh, thank you for your testimony. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you must convict this guy. And that was how it was. I even have a quote somewhere of the juror from the McVeigh trial saying, well, I kept thinking if he really didn't do it, someone would come forward and give him an alibi. And since they didn't, I guess I just had to go along with the government on it. In other words, the government never even proved their case against this guilty guy because they couldn't prove it without proving that they, in fact, were up to their eyeballs in the same damn plot. And its co-conspirators.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 25th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, so the Yemen war. The big deal is the Wall Street Journal yesterday. U.S. widens role in Saudi-led campaign against Houthi rebels in Yemen. Washington has concerns about Riyadh's goals in this conflict. Now, first of all, about this thing, I said it before and I'll repeat it, I guess. I have no reason to really doubt that the Iranians would want to help the Houthis. Just, you know, if only to help make the Saudis have a hard time. If they have any personal affinity for them whatsoever. That's who the Saudis are bombing, then okay, let's give them some guns or something. There's no, you know, certain reason why that can't be true or something like that. But I still have seen no evidence of it. I've seen no one even, and I ain't omniscient, but I'm really trying. I'm reading as much about this as I can. And I don't even hear, you know, anecdotes by anonymous officials saying that they believe so. I just see unproven assertions. As it says here, Iranian-backed Houthi rebels. As though this is just an Iranian, you know, proxy insurgency going on over there. When actually it's much more complicated than that. And when you know the complicated story, or even part of the complicated story, behind the Houthis and their rise to power, you would see that any help that the Iranians are giving them, at least thus far, is completely marginal, is not what's making the difference here, and that it's a bunch of propaganda to try to define what's going on there as an Iranian-backed this or that just for political purposes. And that can be a real problem, because then you end up making that true and you end up making a fight that's not about that, about that. And, you know, someone just sent me a tweet and said, well, hey, you ought to get Adam Morrow on to see... to ask how the Egyptians like being involved in this war. And I bet you they're pissed. And I was reading, a few days ago or whatever, a week ago, about how the Egyptians had got their clocks clean fighting a war in Yemen back, I think, in the 60s or 70s or something. No, the 60s was the 1,000 guys who they sent over there and got nowhere or something. Anyway, they had a massive war there before. And I think the Saudis did too, and it's known as their Vietnam. Or maybe it was Egypt's Vietnam, they call it. Vietnam, again, like America and Afghanistan now, like the Russians in Afghanistan in the 80s. Vietnam is shorthand for a giant, stupid, no-win war that you should have never got in the first place, because all you're doing is pissing all your money away and making everyone hate you and tearing your society apart back at home. And that kind of thing. Some of us still got the syndrome. Others are over it. But anyway, point being that fighting a war in Yemen isn't easy. It looks like a small place on a map. I guess it is, but you know, where the Houthis are based out of is a mountainous area. They've got all the weapons they need. According to State Department documents released by the heroic Chelsea Manning through WikiLeaks, they talk about how the Houthis buy guns from the army they're fighting. There's enough of a black market in guns going on in Yemen. Everybody's got a gun. And a lot of them have those cool curved daggers, too. But, yeah, there's no nobody lacking for weaponry there. And anyway, so the Americans are behind this thing. I mean, the Saudis aren't doing this without a definite okay and promise of cooperation by the Americans. And so that means probably special forces with laser pointers on the ground. It certainly means American AWACS. And those are the planes with the giant radar dishes on top. And the that Ronald Reagan sold to Saudi Arabia over Israel's dead body back in the day when a president could stand up to Israel about something. Well, yeah, it's kind of happening again. The last time a president stood up to Israel about something, I guess I should say. Anyway, and ships at sea, they're using those to organize the war. And they're just getting further into it, even though it says right here the Obama administration is skeptical, not just worried about a possibility. They're favoring the pessimistic view here. The Obama administration is skeptical that the airstrikes will reverse the Houthi gains. So what army are the Saudis going to send in there? They were talking, oh, we got 30,000 men lined up to invade or something like that. Really? Come on. As Eric Margulies always points out on the show, they're afraid to have an army in Saudi Arabia. For the same reason Gaddafi was. An army can overthrow you. So they have basically their own little private Gestapo, the National Guard. And then everybody else just sits around making money and not doing fighting. You know? That's what Americans are for. Doing the Saudis fighting for them. That's what al-Nusra is for. But anyway, so it's only just getting worse there, and it's a huge humanitarian crisis, and part of the proof that it's going to be a complete disaster one way or the other is this story in Al Monitor, why Pakistan said no to King Salman. They want the Pakistanis to come in and fight the war for them, and they said forget it. And as they point out here, when Musharraf did his coup d'etat against the current prime minister, Sharif, back in 1999, the Saudis were the ones who saved Sharif's ass and let him go to exile rather than being put up against the wall back then. And so Sharif owes them a lot, and even still, the political winds, I guess, it was one of those things like Obama in Syria in 2013, take it before the Congress that's sure to kill it. The military doesn't want it. People are pissed off. So he sent it kind of as a dead letter to the Pakistani parliament that voted down any participation in it, and they're telling the Saudis sorry, like Franco to Hitler, you're on your own kind of thing. And yeah, them Saudis, they're bastards, man. They're not quite Nazis, but sure they are. If you're one of their victims, then yeah, they're pretty indistinguishable from a Nazi. Anyway, so yeah, I don't know, man. Really, it's a shame that I can't seem to figure out who's good to talk to about this on the show other than Eric Margulies. I keep trying to get that guy Gregory Johnson, who I think does good work, but he seems to be very busy. And then there's that guy Adam Barron from McClatchy Newspapers, who seems really good on this, but I can't ever seem to get a hold of him either. Maybe they saw me on Twitter and thought, holy crap, this guy. I don't know, man. Anyway, I need to broaden my net there and get better Yemen experts on. At least I can interview Jason from antiwar.com about it. He's up on the latest anyway. But yeah, here's one from the LA Times about how, yeah, they're killing a lot of people, but it's not doing any so-called good. It's not weakening the position of the Houthis at all. And of course, you know, if you go back just a few years, you can see how part of the reason that Saleh was overthrown in 2011 is because American military and financial aid to him, that's the old dictator there, had made him worse. And so the Americans were creating far more al-Qaeda enemies than they had to start with by bombing innocent people in the name of bombing al-Qaeda there, which is creating huge problems. He's already got all the socialist types who are against him. And he's got the al-Qaeda guys on the Sunni side. And then the Zaydis, the Houthis, the Zaydis is the religious branch of Shiism that they follow. Or it's their tribal identity? I don't know. The Houthis is a more political specific term named after one of their leaders from a generation ago. But anyway, Saleh battled against them and made them stronger and then bribed them off. And music's playing. And then, you know, yeah, American intervention led to the mess. That's what I'm trying to say. You know that. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. So Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com today makes the case, the right-wing case or the libertarian case for small government and against empire. Because guess what? You can't have a limited constitutional world empire. It's sort of kind of one or the other. And in an empire, foreign policy dominates all domestic policy. And so he asks the question, and he answers it. He cites the great David Stockman about this. Supposedly Ronald Reagan was going to shrink government, and yet he expanded it and expanded it. Why? Empire. That's why. National greatness. That's why. Because there is no such thing as a Republican, little r, Republican empire. Only just nationalism, basically, in the place of conservatism. That's what's left. And so, anyway, so what he says is, you got to abandon the empire, and then we can get to work on having a small government. Which makes a lot of sense. And especially when we're dealing with a situation where, you know, in politics, you have Tom Cotton. Who is Tom Cotton? Where does this creep come from? And you realize he's going to be a senator for the next 50 years, this guy. You know, if he's not president first. Like, we are stuck with a capital S, stuck with this, literally, Bill Kristol in the Senate. A figurative Bill Kristol, but pretty damn similarly, that simile. Where does he come from? He's a captain in the war. I mean, he was at Harvard, so maybe he would have been a politician anyway. But he actually went and fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the way that he became famous was he wrote a letter to the New York Times saying that they ought to be all tried for treason for running a story about the tracking of terrorist financing that they ran. And that's how he became a star in the right-wing blogosphere and came to the attention of Bill Kristol, who said, oh, you want power? I can hook you up with power. And, you know, I don't know, God bless him, he seems to believe every word out of his mouth, which is really scary. I saw Daniel Larison say, you know, wow, this interview with Jeffrey Goldberg that Tom Cotton did makes me think he's a lot more ideological and serious and dangerous than I had thought. Like, this guy is as bad as it can get. He's blowback from the wars. Who was it? It was somebody horrible that I'm plagiarizing, I think. I forget. Some liberal at Salon.com was saying, you know, he's Ted Cruz with a war record. He's Sarah Palin with a Harvard degree. That's a pretty good way of putting it. And yeah, man, you know, on CNN, they've had him on for half an hour at a time where you hear, boy, is he sure of himself. And much better than John McCain or Lindsey Graham at stumbling through the so-called facts. You know what I mean? He's a guy who really likes to fight and really has all of his talking points straight. As completely full of crap as he is. And he's just too much of a freshman senator to run for president now, I guess. I suppose they could recruit him into this thing. I think that Rand Paul, he's going to always have a real hard time trying to half-ass his arguments against these guys. Because with the lie comes a lot of certainty, a lot of simplicity to be certain about. And, you know, only a fully trained libertarian can fend that kind of thing off. The truth. Some kind of half-ass, oh yeah, well no, you're right about this and that war, but I disagree with you about this and that war. Meh. It's not going to play. And anyway, so that's the political blowback from all this war, is a Congress full of Tom Cottons. And those who would do as expected of them by him. And then on the other side of that, of course, is the economic consequences, of course. All the wasted lives and wasted material and wasted brilliant minds doing research and development on killing instead of on producing things and distributing them, creating wealth. All of those seen and unseen costs of the warfare state that we have in our society. The most seen of them now, and it's all due, I think, to the cell phone camera and to Twitter and Facebook. No matter if you're a completely non-political person, if you have a Facebook account, then you are seeing police brutality daily. If you're on Twitter, you are seeing police brutality daily. And, you know, a friend of mine said, well, yeah, I know, man, it's pretty bad. You know, every few months we hear about these. I said, you know, it's three a day. They kill three Americans a day. And he hadn't heard that. But, you know, it is the case that people more and more, it's getting through their skulls now, finally, about how bad police brutality has gotten. And really, the police brutality has gotten much worse in the sense that now they treat everybody the way that they've always treated blacks. And because they have the impunity to go along with it. But now there's a real collision taking place, because people's attitudes are changing very quickly because of their Twitter and Facebook feed and their cell phone cameras. Hold your cameras sideways for video, please. It's really changing the way people look at this kind of thing. And, you know, a huge part of what's gone wrong, of course, is the drug war. But it's also the blowback from the terror war, where they have all this military equipment and military training, much more so than before. And they're dressed up to such a degree like soldiers, not like pseudo sort of kind of soldiers in SWAT gear, but like really they're dressed up like, you know, the Navy SEALs on their most important mission ever kind of gear. Like, what are you doing? You're patrolling in the neighborhood, in a nice neighborhood. Like, who are you fooling with this stuff, you know, kind of thing. Just armed to the teeth. And then part of that is, you know, they just incorporate that mindset. It's not funny to them. Like, it's kind of ironically funny and scary at the same time, but kind of funny to us. To them, they just take on the truth of it. They're like, I guess
I have to dress like this to be prepared for the battles I must be in. And then they take it out on everybody else. And of course, whatever giant percentage of them are and will continue to be war veterans. And, you know, as highlighted recently, argument on a Facebook page, it was, you know, someone, I don't know, was quoting it, where the cops were saying, this is just like Iraq out here. Like, no, it is not. Stop saying that, man. Not that it's okay to go patrol Iraqi civilians and treat them like this either, but that's an entirely different role. You're supposed to be our security force, supposedly. But that's what they think. They bring that mentality home. And, so yeah, Justin's right. You want government off your back, you gotta get it off the foreigners' back too. You can't just send it abroad to leave you alone. It blows back on you. Gotta be consistent in your opposition to the state.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Me. Hey guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network at libertyradionetwork.com or LRN.FM. Like I always am. Noon to 2 Eastern Time. Liberty Radio Network and the affiliates out there. Hey, affiliates out there. And the people who normally would be in the chat room. I don't know, maybe they are, but I just don't have a Chatzilla or something. It's the IRC Freenode chat room, hashtag Scott Horton Show. You can get in it, but you can't get there by going to scotthorton.org/chat because the website's still down because the website exploded. The server died. It became dead. But so anyway, we're working on that. It's going to be fixed. So, yeah. But anyway. Oh, by the way, I should give you guys an update on the Kickstarter thing. Some people have started to get their rewards. Other people, you're still on the list. Part of the problem is my server's down, so I haven't gotten an email since Friday. That's a legit excuse and not a lie. I haven't gotten an email since Friday. Well, a couple to my old antiwar.com address. But anyway, I haven't gotten everybody's email that I was expecting. So once we get all that straight and I get all my emails, that'll help me. I'll get the rest of those out to you. And once the server gets up, then our guy that we hired, he can get back to work on the job of putting all the interviews on YouTube, which will be really cool. That's the project we're working on. But that reminds me to say extra thank you and gratefulness and all that stuff to everybody who, you know, participated in the Kickstarter, to all the people who donate on a monthly schedule, 5, 10, 20, or 100 bucks. Even a couple people do 100 bucks. There's one guy who donates, I think it's a cent a week. Every week it comes in, one penny. Which I'm pretty sure is, you know, he's being nice. He's, you know. Because you just do 2 cents once if you're trying to be a jerk, right? So, but no, that's cool with me because those pennies add up. So I take it in good spirits. I appreciate all you guys, all the one-off donations. People send in donations here, there, and the other time because they feel like it. Those are great, and I appreciate those too. And I appreciate everybody listening to the show. One thing is, like when I went to that FFF thing, there were a lot of libertarians there. And so there were, you know, at least a handful of people who knew who I was and who were happy to see me and stuff. And so that's really cool to know because usually I just sit here by myself and yell into a microphone. And I know that there are statistics that say that people listen to the show and that kind of thing. But it's nice to meet real live people who are fans of the show and like it for what it is, which is just my attempt to get to the bottom of this stuff for you as best I can. Tell you the truth about how they're lying to all of us about all the horrible things that they do. So, you know, people take it in that spirit and appreciate it for what it is, then cool, man. I'm really appreciative of you guys, and I should say stuff like that more often. So cool. Yeah. I mean, not that I'm kissing your ass or anything. Whatever your opinions are, they probably are wrong, except where they coincide with mine. So, don't think I'm going to change mine for you or anybody else. Anyway, but yeah, thanks for listening. Appreciate it. So, yeah, no, more on the police state here, but I'm not going to dwell on any of them. I just want to kind of go through, I am going to dwell on one of them, but I'm going to go through the others first. Policemen investigate after report of tampering with corpse. They shot and killed this guy, a Medal of Valor winner, after supposedly police chase, whatever. Oh, he reached toward his waistband. No gun was found. Yeah, amazing how people try to hold their pants up. Amazing how the cops don't even have to say, no, I could have swore he had a gun in his hand. Just, he was reaching for his waistband. That's it. Waistband. And they can kill whoever they want. Hey, waistband. And just, that's it. Prove you weren't reaching for your waistband, dead corpse. Ha, you can't. So, therefore, waistband. So then they murdered this guy. And as if he had a gun, that would mean it was okay to kill him, right? How about if he pointed it and threatened with it? How about that? Huh? You think, let's see, what if you killed a cop and then your defense was, hey, he was reaching for his holster. Right? Look at Mike Brown. Mike Brown fought with the cop over his gun. Yeah, maybe because a cop pulled a gun on him and was going to murder him. And he was trying to defend his life. Why else did the cop pull the gun unless he was going to use it? Anyway, see if you kill a cop and say, well, he was reaching for his waistband, and see how far that gets you. Like you would even make it to a trial. But anyway, that's a perfectly valid defense for a cop. Waistband, he's not even in trouble for killing a guy. Nobody's in trouble for killing a guy. Hey, waistband. But no, then they sat there and played with his corpse like Weekend at Bernie's. They desecrated the man's corpse on the side of the road. American police in Bakersfield, California. Man in videotaped police beating alleges retaliation by LAPD. Oh yeah, so they were torturing this guy, but then somebody else filmed it, and so now they're going after him for trying to stand up for himself and by using the video evidence about it. The attorney says the officers had heckled him and his family while driving past their home, which is threatening when you know that they're all armed agents of the state who can kill you with impunity or, you know, beat you with impunity. Last week, the lawyer said, officers drew their guns on him after stopping him for a traffic violation. And so they're suing him in federal court for this. For first beating him and then going after his family and threatening them for sticking up for themselves. This is in the United States of America. Any one of these stories ought to try to be a smart aleck about it and introduce them as, look at these Russian police, what they do. Oh, yeah, no, that's in California. Look at these Chinese communist police, loyal only to the Communist Party that stands for no election to no man ever but themselves. And, that's in Ohio. Check out this one. This is from the police state of Iran. Ooh, Iran. This guy filed a discovery request for some evidence, and they sent it as a thumb drive instead of as an email attachment. What, like he doesn't have enough room in his Hotmail box because it's 2001? So he didn't believe it. So he sent it to his software guy first, and the software guy found four Trojans on the hard drive. This is a defense attorney representing his client. Files for discovery against the police. Give me all the evidence. They send him a thumb drive with four Trojans on it that would allow them to take control of the defense lawyer's computer and all the passwords to his accounts. But anyway, no, they, above all, not you, are to be considered innocent. You're not. But it must have just been an accident, right, that the cops sent a virus-laden thumb drive. But actually, no, that wasn't in Iran. That was, Arkansas. And then we talked about in Fairfax County, Virginia. I mean, in Mexico. Did you hear about in Mexico? The Zetas, not the Sinaloa cartel, because they're good guys. But the Zeta cartel, they tortured this lady to death with a taser. They had her shackled hands and feet. This helpless, mentally ill woman. And then they tortured her to death with a taser. Electroshock torture. Oh, yeah, no, that was in Virginia.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. So, way back when, a long time ago, I used to be a minarchist. I used to think, what are we ever going to do? Get rid of the state in my lifetime, so what's the point? You might as well try to hold them to the Constitution and that kind of thing. And one of my arguments was, hey, what if we had an extremely limited government where, one of its only functions was carrying out as impartial as possible court proceedings for those accused and those sued? And how about if we didn't give our government every responsibility under the sun, but just had them doing a few things, like, for example, holding fair trials for those accused, and then, you know, maybe they could do a good job of that, or a good enough one. But, of course, I don't really believe that, although I think it would certainly be an improvement if that was kind of all they had left as their responsibility, and that was all people had to focus on. To think that our government is going around the world slaughtering people to death by the high numbers in the name of because we're so damn good that our sins become virtues once we commit them. Because we're only doing it for your own good so that you can be advanced and modern and Western like us and all that. When meanwhile, our government is as corrupt as any on the planet. And imprisons a greater percentage of the population of this country than any other place anywhere. Spends more money policing people than any other place on the planet, including communist China, which is really more like fascist China now, but still. It is, in theory, a totalitarian dictatorship. They allow people, even in theory, there's no pretension about whose rights come first. They allow people to trade and own property to some degrees, that kind of thing. But the Communist Party comes first there. But they don't have a police state like we have a police state. They may come after you for talking the way I do, in a way that the American government doesn't come after me, at least not yet, for talking the way I talk. But as far as just destroying the average person's life for no freaking reason whatsoever, they're not as interested in that over there. The way the U.S. government does it. And you can look at, like, the most basic job that you would think from watching TV or, you know, whatever your junior high school civics lesson was probably the last time they tried to teach you any of this stuff in government school anyway, would be that, you know, holding murder trials and making sure that, one, that the people who murder other people, you know, ones who are not in government employment at the time, that those people are held accountable, that nobody gets away with murder. We got to make sure people don't get away with murder. And also we got to make sure that if somebody is accused of murder, that they have a real chance to fight back in court, and they shouldn't have to really prove their case, but they should have a chance to
challenge all their witnesses' testimony and this kind of thing. This is America, not, you know, Russia under the Tsar. Or, you know, the Soviet Union, where you never get to find out what the charges against you even are. Something like that. And yet, look how bad it is. Look how bad they are at it. Look at how many cases. Just think of the small amount of relative effort that even goes toward getting innocent people out of prison, right? This is a very low priority, really, for anyone other than the very few groups who make it their, you know, life's obsession, you know, and pull the weight for everybody else. This isn't even a thing. And yet, you know, I don't even know if there are good estimates of how high the numbers are of the percentage of people who didn't even do the thing they're accused of doing. I think it's probably pretty high. And you can see how screwed up they are from the basic level. Like this argument, you know, from the get-go of their investigations. Two confessions, one by a nervous kid, one by a self-styled hitman, a Detroit whodunit. So it's the Marshall Project, themarshallproject.org, by Andrew Cohen. And obviously whodunit is the hitman, the same one who was able to tell the cops where they could find the murder weapon and correctly describe the caliber of the bullets those weapons fired, unlike the kid that they brutalized, basically, into a false confession that doesn't even hold up itself. Open and shut case if they prosecuted and convicted the wrong guy, a kid. And how do they do it? Torture works. Just ask Dick Cheney. You don't even have to tie somebody up and put them in a horrible stress position and beat the crap out of them. Just put them in a small interrogation room with big, fat, bad breath, stinky cops and hot lights telling them, come on, kid, admit that you did it. You know you did it. We know you did it. Oh, you're going to get the needle, kid. Until the kid finally says, what would the Misesian economists say? They would say that the police succeed in shortening the time preferences of the, I don't know if this really applies, of the victim in this case, the accused, that he will say anything to make this stop now. And so if the promise is, we'll let you go home, just give us something. At that point, the kid doesn't understand, can't comprehend that all he's doing is handing them his own death warrant for his upcoming trial. He's not thinking in terms of what's going to happen at his trial in a few months. All he's thinking of is he's got to get out of this discomfort right now. And so he says, okay, what do you want me to say? And then he says it. Torture works. It can be very minimal, no-touch torture. Bad breath, hot light, little sleep, miss mom. That'll be enough to get a stupid kid who can't understand the forces arrayed against him to go ahead and give in. Simple. What do you want me to say? Saddam taught me and my Al-Qaeda friends how to make chemical weapons? Fine. Taught us how to hijack planes? Sure, yeah, he taught us how to hijack planes. But you promise I get to go home, though, after this, right? Yeah. Back to Gaddafi with you. Thanks. So, that's what happened here. And just look at never even mind the lengths that they were willing to go to keep this boy in prison. I mean, you read this story, it'll make you mad. Two confessions at themarshallproject.com. But never even mind the lengths that they'll go to pretend that they still believe their own stupid story about how this kid supposedly did it instead of the actual murderer who admits that he did it and in a actually credible manner. Never even mind that, which is the real scandal of this thing. But just look at how they build their case. It's all inductive, backwards-ass logic. Basically, the cops are conspiracy theorists. They start with, let's see if we can pin it on this kid. He seems easy. Can we build a case that makes it look like this kid did it? Yeah, I think we can. Okay, now it's not on us anymore. Now we just bring it to the prosecutor. And the prosecutor looks at it and says, can I win a case with this? Do I think I can get a jury to go with this? Yes, I do believe that I can. That's the only standard. Not do I even believe it's true. Just do I think I can win with what the police gave me? Yes, I think I can. blam, it moves to the next stage. Take the thing to trial. When, of course, logic would dictate that a murder detective, a homicide detective, would work the other way and try to disprove the idea that the kid did it. Okay, here's an obvious suspect for whatever stupid reason they decided he was obvious. Let's see if I can poke holes in my own theory that he's responsible, because then that way I'll make sure I don't go off half-cocked accusing an innocent person, and that way I can make sure that I have a better chance to get the actual guilty murderer and prosecute him, which would be a murder detective's job, you might think, if you watch TV. But instead, what do? They said, here's this kid, can we make it seem like he did it? Yes. That's it. They don't consider that framing someone. They consider that their job. This inductive thing. Build a case, cherry pick facts, and ignore other ones and make it look like the kid did it. They're conspiracy kooks, these cops. They're not trying to be scientists about it. They're not trying to disprove themselves and their own way of looking at it. Well, geez, now wait a minute. If this kid did it, then how come there's no blood on his shoes or whatever it is? They don't even, and you know what? I used to love Matlock, but now I think I've decided that he is the greatest enemy of American society. Matlock selling the people on the idea that a prosecutor would care at all and agree with the defense to dismiss if they lost confidence in their own case. That somehow there's fairness at the root of this system. There's not.